You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 23rd of January 2017 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Steve Bloomfield. On today's programme, we'll be asking why women around the world took to the streets to protest against the new president of the United States and what may happen next. We'll also be looking at how the Trump administration is reacting to the press too.
These attempts to lessen the enthusiasm of the inauguration are shameful and wrong.
My guests Isabel Hilton and John Everard will be discussing these and the day's other top stories, including...
I am not going into particular operational details except to confirm that HMS Vengeance successfully concluded demonstration and shakedown operation.
The UK government goes on the defensive regarding claims that its Trident nuclear weapon system isn't up to scratch. We'll also be discussing where the Gambia's former president and the nation itself are headed in the future and asking whether the Samsung brand can turn its fortunes around. That's all to come on Midori House with me, Steve Bloomfield. So welcome one and all to Midori House. My guests today are John Everard, former British ambassador to Belarus, Uruguay and North Korea, and Isabel Hilton, editor of China Dialogue. John and Isabel, welcome to you both. The past weekend saw demonstrators, numbering in their millions, take to the streets of cities across the globe, marching in support of women's rights. The demonstrations were timed to coincide with the inauguration of new US President Donald Trump, who assumed office on Friday. And Isabel Hilton, Donald Trump and the media in a moment, but there were far fewer people in Washington, D.C. on Friday for the inauguration than there were the next day when... probably at least a million or so women, and some men as well, took to the streets.
And you know what? I think that in 4 years' time, the women who were on the streets on Saturday will still be thinking the same way. And who knows what the people who were on the streets on Friday will be thinking. So I think the trend is rather with the bigger crowd here.
John, you know, it's easy to criticise demonstrations, and there have been lots of people who have been trying to criticise those who went on the demonstration, saying, well, you know, it's all very well going on a march, but that doesn't change anything. But quite aside from the fact that marches can change things, it's also a sign, isn't it, that people are not happy with what's happening?
I think that is masterly understatement, Steve. I mean, you know, the anger was quite palpable in those demonstrations. Coming back to your basic point, marches sometimes change things, sometimes don't. I think the chances of changing Donald Trump's mind are vanishingly small. But at least if you are a journalist, and you must right now, given what his press spokesman is saying, be feeling under some kind of pressure, if you're a journalist seeing that a groundswell of opposition to what Trump stands for, you will draw heart. If you're a senator looking at confirming or not confirming some of the more dubious candidates he put forward for top jobs, maybe you'll feel emboldened to go with the people. Let's see how this plays out.
It depends also what you think you want to change. We're up against an administration that admits that it creates its own reality, rather as the neocons did under George W. Bush. So it is a reminder that the majority actually have a reality that they're quite happy with. And I think that certainly what changes for people who go on the march and people who witness the marches is a reminder that actually, yes, there are more of us, and this is what we think, and this is what we will continue to think. It wasn't an angry march in London, at least. I went with my daughter, and it was pretty good humoured. It was full of rather witty placards. It was there was no aggression, and it was very, very big, and it was very determined.
Certainly. No, the one in London certainly was. The one in some of the American cities, they weren't rude, they weren't offensive, but there was real passion flowing through those marches.
It's worth also pointing out that the one in Washington, D.C., there were zero arrests at that, and indeed, I think, many of the others. I guess the question is, though, Isabel, what happens next? How do those that went on these marches build on that and turn it into a more long-running protest movement?
That's always a problem with marches. And certainly, I mean, for those of us who are not in the United States, there's no kind of direct answer in that we can't directly influence US politics. I think in the US, what is clear is that on all kinds of policy fronts, people are organizing resistance at many levels, from the level of state government through cities, through local groups, and through culture wars. Remember, this is quite a long way down, quite a serious culture war at this point. You know, we've had 25 years of reshaping public discourse, of trying to marginalize progressive views. And just engaging on that front, I think, is significant. You know, people will feel less isolated. They will feel that their opinions are more valid. That kind of solidarity does matter when you're in a war of public perception and public persuasion.
John, in terms of for those who aren't in America, what do you think happens next? Because as Isabel says, it's, you know, your influence is a bit more limited there. In that sense, for those who demonstrated there, it's more about making their voice heard and sending a message that people all around the world are unhappy.
Yes, that's certainly part of it. Though, as Isabel said, I mean, there are big questions over whether you can harness this wave of energy and turn it into a long-term protest movement, a long-term opposition to Trump. If you can do that, then that changes the face of American politics and will almost certainly change the nature of the Trump administration. What happens next on the other side? I think we can take it as read that Donald Trump will simply dismiss these women in their pink hats, which, you know, we understand the message. He'll just think it's silly, and say these are just snowflakes, and cast them aside. There's absolutely very little chance that Donald Trump is going to be swayed in his views, even by these numbers, even if he believes in the numbers, which, given his remarks on the crowds at the inauguration, he probably doesn't.
Well, there is the famous US observation that you can't reason a man out of a position he hasn't reasoned himself into. So I think changing Donald Trump's mind is a lost cause, even if you could find it. You know, he's not going to be persuaded by reality, and he only thinks of himself. But he is not the government of the United States. He is not the totality of it. He's occupying the most important office, but he still has to work with Congress. He still has to work with a circle of people who have to run a very large administration. The more entrenched he is and the more absurd he is, the harder that's going to be. And this, after all, is the high point of his popularity. No president goes up from here on the whole. Obama was an exception in that. Most presidents start high on their moment, you know, their first day in office, and they set the tone. He has set an absolutely miserable tone. And I don't think that his ratings are going to improve.
I agree.
John Everard, on the issue of ratings, it brings us nicely to the issue of numbers. Donald Trump may well dispute the fact that his approval ratings are somewhere between 37 and 44%, the lowest ever for a president-elect just before his inauguration. The other numbers he's been disputing over the weekend have been the number of people that came to his inauguration. The media suggested that there were around 250,000, and they showed pictures comparing it to Barack Obama's in 2013 and Barack Obama's in 2009. Certainly in 2009, there were apparently 1.8 million people there. He has shown that not only has he got a rather thin skin by going on about what he thinks the numbers are, but the reaction of not only him, but also his press secretary, Sean Spicer, who delivered an astonishing attack on the media over the weekend. I hesitate to call it a press conference because there were no questions. He just came in and said, "I'm holding you to account." What do those things tell us about the way the Trump White House views the media and what we're going to be in for over the next 4 years?
I think it's quite clear that the Trump White House views the media with deep suspicion, largely because the media very rudely keeps saying things that Donald Trump disagrees with. And this, of course, is disloyal in the Trump universe and is a bad thing. I don't think it's likely there's going to be any kind of comfortable relationship between the Trump White House and the media anytime during his presidency, to be honest. One point that really struck me about Sean Spicer's presentation, if you want to call it that, to the media, the White House press secretary, the new one, was that unlike the various Obama press secretaries who engaged with the media and just sort of said things, they probably had kind of rough speaking notes in front of them, but they just talked off the cuff. He was reading word for word off a carefully prepared script. I wonder who wrote that script. Was it Trump himself? Was it Kellyanne Conway? Somebody high up in the Trump administration? But Sean Spicer clearly was not his own man. And the body language throughout the entire interaction was of a man who really, really wanted to be anywhere but there. I rather felt for him.
But that's day one.
That's day one, yes.
Isabel, but this is more than deep suspicion. This is a deliberate strategy from the Trump administration, isn't it, to ensure that the waters are muddied and there will be people who believe their own eyes and there will be people who believe anything Trump says, and then there'll be people in the middle who are like, well, I don't really know what to believe because everyone's saying blue is red and red is blue.
It's a strategy that goes back to Goebbels. If you repeat a lie often enough, a big lie often enough, eventually quite a lot of people will believe it. And it is also, you know, it's setting out a policy of intimidation. You know, that he was threatening the press. What does holding the press accountable mean exactly? You know, and the idea that they, after all, Trump has held almost no press conferences at all. And the one he had the other week was also bizarre in the extreme. He did not actually answer any questions. And all he can talk about is his own feelings, it would appear, and how great he is. So they're clearly on rocky ground in terms of exposing him to direct questioning. The press is likely to go on insisting on a reality that you can measure and see and view and defend, rather than the Trump administration reality. So all that's left really is intimidation, shouting, and destroying the very notion of observable reality, because observable reality, in this instance at least, is very much against them. So they have to destroy it.
And yet, John, part of the problem here is that different media organisations obviously operate in different ways. And so, for example, the New York Times decided to call out the lie for what it was on its front page. But many other newspapers simply said, reported the story more as Trump bashes media for dishonesty, in quotes. There's a problem with the normal way many journalists do journalism, isn't there? In that this person said this person said that. Whereas this sort of journalism now seems to call for calling out when people actually say things that are untrue.
Absolutely, it requires calling out. We have caught the spokesman of the President of the United States telling lies. Five lies in 5 minutes, somebody worked out, which, as at the first press conference, as Isabel has pointed out, is a shocking start. But, of course, to do so requires a certain amount of moral fibre. And there are many very courageous journalists out there, but there are also quite a lot of journalists who really do not want to pick a fight with a brand new administration.
You've also got to think about what weapons the administration has. You know, this is a big business administration. Are they going to start hitting advertising? Are they going to start trying to hurt newspapers that don't support them? And what we're seeing is an administration that's operating as though it was in a rather more familiar kind of dictatorship, the kind that, you know, we've all seen, except that the press still does have a freedom to point that out. I think that you're absolutely right that the press has got to rethink its approach and think this is not America as we know it. This is not business as usual. We have to start behaving as though this is an authoritarian administration, and we have to start our resistance now. And that may, because they have an enormous respect for the office, I think that may be quite difficult for a number of the press. But the lies are so outrageous and so egregious, I can't see how they can avoid it.
No, I mean, if you do not expose these lies, what are you as a journalist? I ought to point out, it's not just the media. In the last few hours, of course, Trump has summoned the leaders of big business and done the same to them. I mean, tried to intimidate them into not investing where their business leads them to invest. Bring it all home, and if you build it outside the United States, we're going to tax you. Not a good start with that constituency either.
Okay, let's move on now to Gambia, where the country's former president, Yahya Jammeh, has left the country after 22 years in power and since hanging on after an election defeat that took place in December. But as he was leaving, he also reportedly took with him just over £9 million worth of assets stripped from the nation's coffers. John, You were based in Gambia not so long ago.
No, I wasn't based there. I used to run the relationship out of London.
Okay,
just
there we are.
After Jammeh came to power. Jammeh, of course, in power 22 years. His predecessor, Jawara, was in power for 32 years. So there's a certain sort of lack of...
A good news story, then.
A good news story, that's right, yes. The man who left power 10 years early. An extraordinary country, an extraordinary series of events. I think the basic lesson that Jammeh, the arch-dictator, takes away is that if you are going to allow a free election in your country, make sure that you do not allow the individual polling districts to declare separately. Bring all the votes into a big counting centre where you can fix the outcome. Otherwise, mistakes might get made. I don't suppose he'd ever make that mistake again. The other fascinating point about what's happened in the Gambia is the concerted action by the West Africans. ECOWAS at last showing mettle, standing up for its principles, and doing so in a brisk and determined manner. I mean, ECOWAS made clear there was no two ways about it.
This is the West African states.
That's right, yes, ECOWAS, the Economic Community of West African States, ECOWAS to its friends, and indeed the African Union playing a kind of Greek chorus role in the background. But they made clear, you know, to Jammeh that either he abided by the result of the election, or there were going to be Guinean tanks rolling into the streets of Banjul. For anybody who knows West Africa, the idea of Guinean tanks of all countries rolling into Banjul to support democracy makes one's jaw drop. But anyway, that was what was on offer. The threat, rather.
Isabel, when we look at West Africa now, then you can say that technically every country there in that region is a democracy.
Which is extremely encouraging, and I agree that this is a good news story, and ECOWAS did behave, you know, pretty well under the circumstances. It still leaves the Gambia pretty impoverished after this long dictatorship. This is an economy that depends largely on groundnuts and tourism, so it's not a rich oil state. It doesn't have huge amounts to steal, but what there was has pretty much been stolen. And I don't think that very much of it is going to come back, actually. You know, there are efforts, and there are a lot of lip services paid to recovering stolen assets. Most of these stolen assets end up in Swiss bank accounts, London bank accounts, US banks. And despite a lot of lip service paid by these governments towards the recovery of these assets, not a whole lot does go back.
Well, in the case of the Gambia, it seems that what Jammeh did was to stuff his aircraft full of Dalasi, Gambian currencies, in cash.
He's a very stupid man.
Well, yes. I think I might have done it differently if I were a fleeing dictator. So it is actually open to the incoming to Adama Barrow's administration, simply to demonetize those banknotes and start all over again.
So is he going to go to some, you know, exchange bureau in the airport in Equatorial Guinea and say, I've got...
With a container load of...
Several crate loads of currency to exchange.
Perhaps so. I mean, the whole...
He deserved to lose this election. This man can't even steal the
He's not going to get a very good rate if he does.
No.
John, I mean, in a way, this is, as we're saying, this is a good news story. It's slightly unfortunate in a way that he has been able to go into exile. He's not going to stand trial for the many, many crimes he's accused of. But is that actually the price we have to pay for a democratic transfer of power?
Yes, in West Africa, effectively it is. I mean, almost all the West African countries now are more or less functioning, more or less democracies, but very few...
But there are caveats in there, in all of those.
There are lots of caveats, and very few of the dictatorships that the democracies toppled had to face up to justice of any kind for their crimes. But Jammeh, will he ever face a court? The fact is that in the grand scheme of things, I mean, Jammeh was a crook, of course he was, but as he wasn't by any means one of West Africa's most brutal dictators, he was nasty to relatively small numbers of people, and I suspect in any case the international system has got other fish to fry right now.
I think also that if you're going to establish democracy, it has to be safe to leave power. Now, clearly he didn't actually expect to lose or wish to leave, but In any of these democracies, if you start prosecuting the outgoing incumbent, you're much less likely to have an election next time round.
Well, remember,
not safe to leave power.
Last time out, Jawara, Jammeh's predecessor, stayed in the Gambia. He still sits out in the town of Hawara, upriver.
Okay, well, there we are. He could have stayed. He could have stayed. We're going to take a quick pause there. John, Isabel, thank you both. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. We're back after this.
A new year is upon us and a fresh issue of Monocle is hitting the newsstand. Eager to start the year as we mean to go on, we've packed the February issue full of ideas for how to make our cities and our lives healthier, smoother, and, well, just better. In our 100th issue, we take a whistle-stop tour of three cities designed for healthy living, offer up some lessons, courtesy of a group of Dutch nuns, on how to learn a new foreign language, and we discover the smartest methods out there for making cities safer. The February issue of Monocle will have you shaking off any final vestiges of holiday slumber and sprinting into 2017 well-informed and suitably inspired. Monocle's February issue. Buy your copy today. Happy reading.
You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Steve Bloomfield. Still with me here in the studio, John Everard and Isabel Hilton. The Samsung brand is in crisis. Not only has it had to contend with faulty exploding phones, constantly hitting the headlines, but the group CEO has also become embroiled in the political scandal that claimed the career of South Korean President Park Geun-hye. This isn't a good look for one of the world's premier tech brands. John, in Korea, business and politics are mixed like they are in few other nations. Just how bad is this for Samsung and how bad is this for brand Korea?
It's pretty bad. I mean, Samsung is a very large part of brand Korea. Well over a quarter of the value of the Korean stock exchange is Samsung in its various forms and guises. Of course, Samsung is isn't a single company. It's a sprawling network of different ones. But the fact that they've had to recall their flagship phone and then abandon that the relaunch that followed it, it's cost Samsung enormous amounts of money, over $5 billion they estimate, although Samsung never released the figures. And it puts it well behind in the race with Apple. Apple, of course, have been dropping heavy hints that they're about to launch a new super-duper phone with all kinds of technical advances that Samsung is not going to be able to meet, simply because, you know, so much of the budget has been blown on this dispute. The S8, due out later this year, not to be launched in the spring fair, it turns out. So clearly a delay there. We are heading towards a situation where Apple's dominance of the mobile phone market, at least the upper end of it, becomes almost total. We're going to have Apple at the top and then the smaller the Chinese producers down the bottom and Samsung sort of squeezed out of the middle. It's looking pretty bad.
And Isabel, from a Korean political point of view, this is just one more bad story in a run of terrible stories.
Absolutely. And I think that this crisis will just drag on. I mean, there doesn't seem to be any clean way out of either the political crisis or the degradation of the Samsung and the Korean brand. So I think it's hard times for South Korea, actually, at a time internationally when they're facing rather complicated set of pressures in addition.
And how? I mean, mercifully, Kim Jong-un did not launch a missile over Donald Trump's inauguration. A lot of people thought he would, but the tensions remain. One small shaft of light in all this, if you were looking for light, is that Lee Jae-yong, the chief executive of Samsung, was not actually arrested. It was a close shave. He spent the night in police cells, which for a man of that background must have been pretty tough. But the judge in the end decided there was not sufficient evidence to prosecute. And the investigators on the Chaesongsil scandal are now looking at other conglomerates. So Samsung must be hoping against hope that spotlight will shift to other chaebol and away from them.
I think, too, that unlike the German car scandal, this isn't a case of I think it's, as I understand it, not a case of deliberate fraud. You know, they didn't cheat. They were perhaps incompetent, you could say. The testing wasn't thorough enough. They were using a battery that didn't stand up. But they didn't actually set out to cheat the system the way Volkswagen did.
The bad batteries, that was just a technical error.
Yes.
32 billion won in donations to Chaesongsil's favourite charities is another matter.
That's another matter, yes.
Indeed.
Yes.
Okay, and on that note, we'll move on to our final story of the evening. The UK's Prime Minister, Theresa May, is having to defend herself against accusations that she has been less than transparent regarding the country's Trident missile system. The multi-billion pound nuclear deterrent reportedly misfired during a recent drill. But can a world leader ever fully reveal their nuclear hand? Isabel Hilton, it's not much of a deterrent, is it, if you publicise the fact that you've carried out a test and it failed?
Well, you know, I think the case would be stronger if they didn't regularly report on successful tests. You know, what if you're going to report on them when they work? I think you ought to own up to the fact that this thing, you know, was heading towards Florida when it self-destructed, particularly since the White House has actually told us that, and something that we weren't allowed to know from our own Prime Minister. The problem with defence, is, and particularly nuclear defence, is that it is layer upon layer upon layer of secrecy. And, you know, to say we can't, it just makes it too convenient when something goes wrong to say we never talk about it. They do talk about it. They talk about it when it suits them, but they never really tell the truth.
And in this case, John, as Isabel points out, it's very hard to keep quiet when other countries know. And it was interesting while Michael Fallon, the defence secretary, was on his feet in the House of Commons today saying, we don't comment on this. CNN was commenting on it because they've been told by the Pentagon.
Yes, that's right. I mean, Michael Fallon knows full well, of course, that everybody's going to find out about this story because CNN and many others have been fully briefed by the White House and many others, including doubtless the Pentagon, on whatever details the United States has. There's a difference, though, between telling somebody something so they know it and actually telling them something which makes a confirmation by the British government. And that is what he was trying to avoid, I think. Whether it's wise to do so, you know, we can argue the toss till the cows come home. But quite clearly, this was a very sad misfire. It's inevitable. If you fire a sequence of test missiles, from time to time, one is going to misfire. That's just the nature of technology. That doesn't necessarily invalidate the Trident deterrent. But it does
make people wonder whether, well, if it goes wrong in a test, will it go wrong when a country actually needs it?
Yes, of course it does. And the answer is that once in a while, even when you fire a missile live, it's going to fail. Yes.
Yeah, but I think that the difficulty here was one of political misfiring. I think it would have mattered less because people are reasonable. They understand that you test things to know if they're still working. Occasionally one doesn't, as you say, although it is pretty alarming. But the fact was that 4 days after she came into office, Theresa May had to lead a debate on the renewal of Trident, which is a highly contentious issue in this country. It's 40 billion. Is it appropriate? And she did not talk about this, and she clearly knew. Now, that's political manipulation and deception, and that's her problem.
Yeah, and yet, John Everard, one could argue that actually a misfire in a test of the old system is perhaps an example of why a new system is needed. It could have been spun that way.
You could have spun it that way. There's all kinds of things you could have done. You could have essentially told Parliament that there was a technical issue over Trident and insist the Royal Navy conduct a further test, make sure it fires, and then go to Parliament and say, you see, it works. There's all kinds of things that could have been done, but they weren't. And of course, the government did have other things on its mind at the time. But nevertheless, I think...
Governments always have other things on their mind.
Tell me about it. clearly, there was a lot of things that I think senior ministers would be wishing they had done at the time and didn't.
Isabel, can we also chalk this up to, you know, this is one of the consequences of living in a democracy as opposed to an autocracy, is that, you know, it might not be convenient to have these things out in the open if you're in government, but that's what has to happen if you're a democracy.
Up to a point, although the day that nuclear policy really is out in the open, you know, honestly, I will eat my hat. You know, our nuclear arrangements are part of a deep state arrangement with the United States, which I think we will never get to the bottom of. And the consequences of them are not just in military and in defence and whether our defence is the right shape for the 21st century, but it spills over into civil nuclear power. That's why we have power stations. They're intimately related. One of the reasons that Hinkley Point C decision was made to go ahead was that we need to train new nuclear engineers because we have a nuclear defence policy. It is a very, very sprawling and you know, a submerged set of icebergs here.
And John, just briefly, do you think this story will just float away, or do you think it could lead to a renewed debate about how open this country is about its nuclear weapons?
I suspect that it will float away. The government is clearly trying very hard not to give it any kind of oxygen. There's a lot of other news around at the moment that will probably simply suffocate it. And I suspect that in fortnight's time, we'll have forgotten this one.
OK, we'll leave it there. John Everard, Isabel Hilton, thank you both very much indeed. That's that for today's Midori House. It was produced by Tom Hall, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Elisa Mayer. The studio manager was Toby Hammond. More music next. Then at 1900, it's Culture with Rob Bound. Do stay tuned for that. The Monocle Daily follows at 2200. Midori House back at the same time tomorrow, 1800 in London. That's 1300 in New York City, if you're listening there. I'm Steve Bloomfield. Have a great rest of the day. Goodbye.